In the months following the end of the Second World War, Europe was in chaos. Millions of refugees were on the road. And the Allies were struggling to deal with huge numbers of surrendering German soldiers. For the rest of the world, the war ended in 1945. But for Nakan, it was just beginning. In his 80s and living on an Israeli kibbutz, Miller was a veteran of a unit called the Jewish Brigade. The Jewish Brigade was in fact part of the British Army, though its recruits were composed of Jews from the Middle East and Europe. In 1945, the brigade was briefly stationed in northern Italy. But with the fighting over, Miller and his friends, without the knowledge of their British commanders, decided to hunt down and kill anyone.
They put on the trucks, "Die Juden kommen," "The Jews are coming," to frighten the population.
Brigade squads always used British uniforms, pretending to be on official business.
אני זוכר מקרה אחד, תחפור את הקבר שלך. אז רבע שעה הוא חפר, אני עמדתי... והוא חפר, חפר, כשהיה קצת יותר עמוק שאפשר לשכב בפנים. בום וזהו.
One of them was led by Abba Kovner. With Allied victory in 1945, many Jewish partisans returned to their homes and began to settle old scores. But for Abba Kovner, this wasn't enough. Leaving the lynch mobs to others, he decided to set up his own private army. From Vilna, he already knew partisans who shared his goals, among them Menachem and Vitka Kempner, who'd fought by Kovner's side in the Vilna ghetto. She later became his lover. But he also recruited new members. Pasha Reichman was one, a partisan from the Ukraine. With Reichman and others on board, Kovner soon had around 50 volunteers. He now gave them a name, Nakam. But before he could begin his own hunt, he first had another job. The Brika, or Exodus, was a massive movement of Jews after the war from Europe to the Middle East. In 1945, there was, as yet, no state of Israel. Instead, Palestine, as it was then called, was controlled by the British. Fearing Arab unrest, they had restricted the number of Jewish immigrants to 10,000 a year. Abba Kovner, a Zionist, he now decided to help smash the British blockade. From the summer of 1945, the Nakam was heavily involved in smuggling Jews to Palestine. But even as Kovner aided the Brika, he was at the same time plotting a monumental act. Rackham's target, the entire populations of four German cities: Nuremberg, Hamburg, Frankfurt, and Munich. In charge of logistics for the operation, Yehuda Maimon.
אנחנו רצינו להרעיר 6 מיליון גרמנים.
The mass murder of 6 million German citizens would be carried out by contaminating water supplies with a poison. His idea to poison the water supplies of four major cities, known simply as Plan A, was deliberately random. Kovner wanted Germans to experience the horror of indiscriminate murder.
הייתה קבוצה שראתה את המעשה כחובה. אנחנו ראינו את זה כשליחים של העם היהודי.
But to murder 6 million Germans through their tap water would take meticulous planning. Immediately, Kovner dispatched small Nakam cells to each of the target cities.
First of all, they investigated how the water supply was distributed in all these cities. They had people posing like workers, like engineers. They used all these kind of disguises to get into the mains, to get the plans in the city halls, and they succeeded to get the full plans. They found the mains where they could actually pour the poison into the pipes.
By August 1945, the Nakam were now close to making the attack possible. But before they could strike, Kovner hesitated. Leaving his teams in Germany, he now traveled alone to Palestine. He'd come to secure the blessing of the Jewish leadership. Unhappy with British rule in Palestine, the most important faction known as the Haganah had, since the 1920s, run its own defense force in the region. Now, increasingly involved in politics, many believed that when the British finally pulled out of Palestine, it would be the Haganah who would take the reins of power.
Abba came and met with the leaders of Palestine. Not with all of them, but with some of them. And they all reported to Ben-Gurion.
David Ben-Gurion was the acknowledged leader of the Haganah. His dream was of an independent Jewish state.
Meeting at the White House, Dr. Chaim Weizmann, the guest of U.S. President Harry Truman.
Second only to Ben-Gurion himself, Chaim Weizmann was one of the Jewish people's most revered figureheads. Destined to become the first president of Israel, he was also a world-renowned chemist, based at the Seif Institute near Tel Aviv, a building today renamed in his honor. Kovner received Weizmann's blessing, but also Weizmann helped him obtain the poison he needed for his attack. The poison came from two brothers, Ephraim and Aharon Katzir. The Katzirs were microbiologists at Weizmann's lab, and they were now instructed by Weizmann to give him the poison he needed. Back in Europe, the people of Germany carried on with their daily lives, oblivious to the impending attack. Hidden amongst them, Kovner's sleeper cells knew nothing of the political maneuvering going on in Palestine. But the strain of waiting, month after month, was beginning to tell.
They had no money. They had no work. They lived under an assumed identity. They were cut off from everyone. They were isolated.
By December 1945, Kovner had finally got his poison and was ready to return to Germany. Taking it with him, he slipped onto a British destroyer in Alexandria. But he never made it. For reasons which even today remain unclear, Kovner was arrested on board ship. News of the arrest soon reached Europe.
At a certain stage, I got an order to hold with the water.
וזו הייתה מכה נוראית. ראינו את אירופה משתנה, והנה החומר אלינו, אז לא נוכל לעשות שום דבר.
But Menachem was still hopeful.
I wasn't told that it's stopped. I was told that it's on ice. Which meant the day will come, we'll do it.
Countless Germans had been saved. But Kovner's arrest remained shrouded in mystery. Even today, people wonder what had really happened. Whatever the truth, Kovner was now in jail. Plan A was in crisis. However, he still wasn't out of the fight. In Europe, the rest of the Nakam quickly regrouped. Even without their leader, they had decided to carry on. From now on, Paris would be Nakam headquarters. Here, Pasha Reichman took charge of European operations, with Kovner's lover, Witke Kempner, working alongside. Plan A may have been history, but now it was time to launch Kovner's Plan B. Plan B now focused on Nuremberg. Devastated by Allied bombing, the city was in ruins, but Kovner still had a Nakam cell positioned there. Leading it was his old friend from the Vilna ghetto, Menachem. Plan B was a much smaller proposition than Plan A, but once again, the chosen method was poison. Close to a camp called Stalag 13, Menachem had identified a bakery which supplied the prisoners with their daily ration of bread. Now he needed to work out a way of poisoning it.
They took a man of ours, and I helped him to get into the bakery or the bread. And he learned everything.
Lepke Distel was Menachem's man on the inside. For weeks, he played the role of trainee baker to perfection. Meanwhile, in Paris, a chemist sympathetic to the cause was brought in to supply a large quantity of arsenic. This was then smuggled to Menachem in Nuremberg. This time, nothing went wrong.
The material which was brought to me was brought by a soldier from the Jewish brigade, and it was in hot water bottles bound around his body. We smuggled in the bottles into the bakery. So we created a place to hide under the wooden floor in case of something, which was very useful, and we kept two more bottles in reserve. And then we decided that we're ready to do it.
In the small hours of April the 13th, 1946, Distel, having hidden in a basket as the other bakers left for home, now began preparing the poison. Working with two accomplices he'd smuggled inside, there was very little time.
These people at night were standing in a bakery and preparing the poison, and others were just putting it on the bread.
Each poisoned loaf would, within hours, be cut into quarters and served to four prisoners.
They smelled 3,000 breads, which was enough for 12,000.
As dawn arrived, the poison bread made its way to the prison camp. But had the plan worked? A day later, snippets of information suggested it had. Menachem now brought in an old friend to find out more. He'd met Rachel Glicksman in Vilna after the war. Now in Nuremberg, she was dispatched to find out what had happened at the camp.
עשו את הכל בשביל להציל אותם. לפי מה שסיפרו לי אנשים אחדים, כולם עשו שטיפות קיבה והצילו את כולם. ולכן לא עשו חקירות. זהו. עכשיו אספתי את כל העיתונים שהיו שם בסביבה, וגם עיתונים שהגיעו ממקומות אחרים, אבל בהם היה מעט מאוד, היה בסך הכל אותו דבר, שכאלף אנשים נפגעו, אבל אף אחד לא מת, כולם עשו להם שטיפות קיבה והצילו את אותם.
For the Nakam, it was another failure. Had the poison simply made the inmates ill?
I don't know how many, but what I know is that the American army has mobilized all the ambulances, and they had thousands, and they were carrying them to all the possible hospitals, and they were pumping them, pumping out.
Despite American attempts to play the attack down, on April the 24th, the story went global. The American press reported nearly 2,300 victims were in hospital, but again, no deaths.
I didn't feel comfortable because I did hope for more. But what could I do? Maybe the material wasn't strong enough.
All regretted the failure of the Stalag 13 bread poisoning. But what hurt even more was the fact that the first plan, the murder of 6 million Germans, was never even attempted at the time. Pasha Reichman, Kovner's fellow Nakam, also regretted the failure of Plan A.
My father always was of the opinion that it should have been carried out. At the same time, he was very proud of being one of the authors of this chapter in Jewish history.
If you ask me if I say the same thing today, yes, the same. I say that we were right.
Kovner once said, when he heard about the American atomic bomb thrown on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, had I had an atomic bomb, I would have let it fall on Germany.
After a year in jail, Kovner was released. The question was, what would he do next?
First films from Jerusalem as the clock runs out to mark the end of British rule. As the zero hour approaches, General Sir Alan Cunningham, High Commissioner for Palestine, and other British officers lead the forces that leave the Holy City for the final time.
In 1948, the British withdrew from Palestine. On the 14th of May, David Ben-Gurion formally declared an independent state of Israel. Almost immediately, the state of Israel came under attack as several Arab states invaded.
Israel in its first years was really struggling for survival. It had to fight five or six Arab countries which were determined to destroy it and to annihilate it and to drown it in blood and all these kind of terrible threats. So all the efforts, all the energy was channeled into survival.
Kovner now had a choice. To go back to Germany and try once more, or to give up and defend his new country. Kovner chose Israel.
The moment Abba Kovner came to Israel, he became an officer in one of the most famous fighting units in the south.
Back in Europe, other Jewish Nakam decided to keep going. In 1949, Wilhelm Stuckart died in a mysterious car accident. 1954, Otto Abetz, German ambassador to France during the occupation, was also found dead in a burning vehicle. 1976, tank commander Joachim Peiper was tracked to his retirement home in France and killed in a firebomb attack. The rules of engagement at Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, changed. Mossad agents were fit, highly motivated, and superbly trained. Experts in sabotage and psychological warfare. Their ranks were largely comprised of ex-underground fighters, Jewish partisans who'd arrived from Europe after the war, and some Nakam. By the 1960s, Mossad had become one of the most efficient and ruthless intelligence services in the world. In 1964, a Mossad agent traveled to Sao Paulo in Brazil. His orders were to hunt down Herbert Sukers. Sukers, from Lithuania, one of the Baltic states, was accused of collaborating during the war. He'd escaped to South America, where 20 years later, Mossad agent Anton Kunzler tracked him down. Posing as an Austrian businessman, Kunzler made contact at a marina where Sukers operated a small sightseeing business.
Sukers was very suspicious all the time. Told him I can take you for a flight around the Sao Paulo and see what's going on, and he said okay, and they went for a short flight. And after this, Tsukos was enough impressed by Anton Künzler's hints that he's a businessman and he's looking for investors and he's looking for partners, etc. He invited him to have a drink on his small boat. And from this moment on, Tsukos started eating the bait that Künzler gave him.
After befriending and gaining Suker's trust over 4 weeks, Künzler lured his prey to the city of Montevideo in Uruguay. waiting at a suburban house were other members of the Mossad team. The plan was to restrain Sukers, hold a brief trial, then kill him.
He said something in German, "Lass mich sprechen," yeah? let me talk. But then the gun with the silencer came back to action, and they shot him twice in the head.
Eleven days later, police entered the house. Inside, the body had been left in a trunk. Above it was a folder. It contained a note stating Sukers had been condemned to death. The murder of Herbert Sukers remains the only state-sponsored killing that Israel has ever admitted to. Though some believe it's not the only killing they've carried out. Mossad may have remained discreet, but in recent years many other accounts have, for the first time, admitted their roles in shocking operations. Men like Chaim Miller, member of the Jewish Brigade's assassination squad. Yehuda Maimon, Abakovna's head of logistics. And Menachem, leader of Nakam's Nuremberg cell.
That which has happened is a warning. To forget it is guilt. It was possible for this to happen. And it remains possible for it to happen again at any minute.
Thanks to the vast Jewish funding of clergy's pan-European movement, it began to pick up steam. In 1925, Richard published another book entitled Praktischer Idealismus, or Practical Idealism. In this book, clergy indicates that the residents of the future, quote, United States of Europe will not be the people of the old continent, but a kind of subhuman mud race. He clearly states that the peoples of Europe should interbreed with Asians, now remember, Arabs are Asians, and colored races, thus creating a multinational flock with no identity or roots, and can easily be controlled by the ruling elite. Kalergi proclaims the destruction of the right of self-determination and then the elimination of nations with the use of ethnic separatist movements and mass immigration in order for Europe to be rebuilt and controlled much easier by the elite. His vision is to turn the proud people of Europe into one homogeneous mixed breed of blacks, whites, and Asians. Who is this elite? Kalergi is abundantly clear that the elite are so-called Jews. An excerpt from Practical Idealism. Quote, "The man of the future will be of mixed race. The races and classes of today will gradually disappear due to the elimination of space, time, and prejudice. The Eurasian Negroid is the race of the future. Similar in appearance to the ancient Egyptians, they will replace the diversities of the people and the diversity of the individuals. Instead of destroying European Judaism, Europe, against her will, refined and educated, this people will be driving them to their future status as a leading nation through this artificial evolutionary process. Insofar as Europe is Christian, it is in a spiritual sense Jewish. Insofar Europe is moral, it is Jewish. Almost all European ethics are rooted in Jewry. All protagonists for religious or non-religious Christian morality, from Augustine to Rousseau to Kant to Tolstoy, were Jews, of choice in a spiritual sense. Nietzsche is the only non-Jew, the only European heathen moralist. In the East, the Chinese people are ethnically par excellence. In the West, it is the Jews. Strength of character, paired with the sharpness of mind, predestines the Jews and their most excellent specimen to become the leaders of urbane humanity. From the false to the genuine spiritual aristocrats to the protagonist of capitalism, as well as of the revolution. Now we stand at the threshold of the third epoch of the new times, socialism. Also, socialism is supported by the urban class of industrial workers, led by the aristocracy of revolutionary writers. This development, and with it, the chaos of modern politics, will only then find its end, when a spiritual aristocracy seizes the means of power of society. Richard Kalergi, 1925.